sharing this. This is going to be a sort of round table format, so everybody has 10 minutes to start with, which will allow us a longer time for questions from the floor. So well done for getting to this point, I think. It's quite a warm room. I think we deserve a medal at the end of the day, but it's testament to how interesting the papers have been that we are still here and engaged. So, if we take them in the order of the programme, we're going to start with Professor Tom Lawson from Northumbria University, Newcastle.
Thank you very much. I was saying to Alison before, I'm going to leave before the end of this session because I need to get a train. So when I get up and walk out, it won't be because, you know, there's been some sort of terrible turn in the conversation, or at least don't interpret it that. It's just because one has to get back to the North East. So I've been asked to talk about around the theme of remembrance, which I'm going to try and do. And I mean, that will partly follow on from what Shirley was talking about in terms of a focus on the Holocaust, because I'm primarily, I guess, a Holocaust historian. I edit a journal called Holocaust Studies. I've spent my life thinking about the Holocaust. It's important, in a sense, to give you that context, because some of the things that I'm going to say about the way in which we remember the Holocaust might suggest that I'm not overwhelmingly committed to Holocaust education, which isn't the case. I'm just not really committed to the direction it takes at the moment. Before I talk about the Holocaust, though, I just wanted to think about one thing that I guess we haven't really talked about in terms of remembrance. We've had a lot of papers about how young people engage with the Great War. We've had a lot of powerful sense of people, it seems, of young people as agents in their learning, as taking control of that learning, of kind of really putting themselves into those into the creation of historical narratives. But I wonder, one of the things I guess that we haven't talked about is, in a sense, there is a point in the year we're about to come into it when there is a really suffocating culture of remembrance around the Great War, a really suffocating discourse around it. I think someone said earlier that, you know, there are no right or wrong answers. Well, there is a period in the year, it seems to me, in the UK, when there very much are some right or wrong answers. And in a sense, you know, public figures cannot leave the house without wearing a poppy. That kind of discourse, and I really wonder, I have no sense of the impact that has on young people, but I'd really be interested to other than the anecdotal sense I have from, you know, my children, but there is a kind of, I do think there is an increasingly determined narrative around, what war means and what remembrance means around that time of year, and I'm just kind of intrigued and slightly, I guess, kind of disturbed by that. And I think it's quite similar with the Holocaust, and I'm going to try and talk about that at greater length. If my colleague Andy Pearson works at the Institute of Education were here, he would speak at great length about why education and remembrance are very different things, that we shouldn't confuse the two, and so on. And I agree with Andy's position on that. But I guess I would reflect that, as far as Holocaust education is concerned, the two have become hopelessly, perhaps permanently, confused, and that has had, I think, in the UK, some very curious effects. So Holocaust education is often suffused with a remembrance purpose, it seems to me, a very moral purpose. We're told often about the need to remember, that somehow simply by remembering we can live up to the incantation, never again. And there are some really lofty goals within this. When David Cameron launched his Holocaust Commission in 2013, the final report of that commission, which was entitled A Promise to Remember, pledged that the outcomes of Holocaust remembrance would be literally transformational. And I quote from it, "In educating young people about the Holocaust, Britain reaffirms its commitment to stand up against prejudice and hatred in all its forms. The prize," and this is the best bit, it seems to me, "the prize is empathetic citizens with tolerance for the beliefs and cultures of others." So Holocaust education is cast in this way as somehow, and remembering the Holocaust, somehow being able to transform the culture, which is quite a claim, it seems to me, that we can somehow heal communal divisions, strengthen democracy, just by learning about these set of events. And of course, that promise to remember is now going to be cast in stone with the building of a permanent Holocaust memorial in Westminster, which will be constructed in 2020 or 2021. Now, there is something of a gap, it seems to me, between that rhetoric of remembrance and reality I think is summed up, it seems to me, by the very fact that the memorial will be completed after Britain has left the European Union, at the behest of a significant minority of its empathetic citizens whose identification with other cultures is open to question. Now, I'm being slightly flippant about that, but it's not an entirely flippant point, because it seems to me it does really highlight some of the limits of the kind of didactic purpose of Holocaust remembrance. Britain's turn to Holocaust memorialisation remembrance probably took place in the late 80s and then into the 1990s, and it was in some senses, a very European affair. It was cemented in the form of a Holocaust Memorial Day, an EU initiative, under a very European-focused Labour government. And my sense is that there was a determination that thinking about the Holocaust was ultimately supposed to kind of replace the sort of very well-alone narrative that Britain held around the Second World War. Tony Blair once very famously told MEPs that the war was over, and that placing the Holocaust at the centre of our conception of that war was a kind of reorientation, it seems to me, of Britain's war experience. But that is a reorientation that has got, it seems to me, shallow roots, and it was unable, it has been unable, to disrupt some very established ways of thinking about the Second World War, established narratives. And I think this is really well demonstrated in the report that was published, I think, towards the end of last year or the year before, by the Institute of Education about the level of young people's engagement with the Holocaust, the level of their knowledge of the Holocaust. And this was a huge empirical study surveying and interviewing thousands of students. It's an exhaustive piece of work. I think it's quite an impressive piece of work. In some ways, it is a very detailed... I mean, on the one hand, it's about what students know about the Holocaust, but it's actually a really detailed piece of work, probably the most detailed piece of work about Britain's collective memory, in some senses, of an event or a set of events. So what does it tell us about what students know about the Holocaust? And after all, one has to cast this as... asking students that question comes after a period of very intensive Holocaust education and remembrance activity, right? So since certainly the 90s and into the new century. So what do students know? Well, I wrote an article about this, and I rather hyperbolically, and is there anything more conceited than to quote from one's own work? I'm not sure, but that's what I'm about to do. I wrote, to put it bluntly, most students do not know who died in the Holocaust, they do not know who killed those unnamed victims, they do not know why, and they do not know where those murders took place. I might have added to that that they also really have no real idea of how that history does and does not interact with the history of the United Kingdom. So it's a doleful tale, it seems to me, about what actually has been the result of this kind of hyper-engagement with the Holocaust in the UK over the last two decades. And to develop that last point, Britain's school children, the report tells us, largely think of the role of the Holocaust in the Second World War. They think about the Holocaust, the Second World War, as having been fought on behalf of the Jews of Europe in some way, and that their rescue was one of its central aims, where, of course, we know Britain's wartime Home Secretary Herbert Morrison stated very clearly that one of the aims of Britain's refugee policy should be that no Jew reaches these shores. So what that tells me is that there's been a kind of grafting of the Holocaust onto more embedded ways of remembering the Second World War, in which Britain remembers itself as somehow the kind of light of the world. And I'm going to demonstrate that with the sort of another quotation, long quotation, toe-curling quotation, really, from Ian Austin MP, who told the House of Commons in one of their now annual Holocaust Memorial Day debates, and I quote at length, "The fact that there are no tracks leading from Britain to Auschwitz tells us something very special about our country. When other countries were rounding up their Jews and herding them onto trains, Britain provided a safe haven for tens of thousands of refugee children." He didn't mention those refugee children's parents. Just one country was fighting not just for Britain's freedom, but for the world's liberty. Britain didn't just win the war, we won the right for people around the world to live in freedom. For me, that period defines our country. It's what makes Britain the greatest country in the world, with special claim to the values of democracy, freedom, fairness, and tolerance. Because of who we are as a people, what we are as a country, the British people came together, stood up to the Nazis, and fought fascism. We are a country that does not walk away or turn a blind eye, and this is where it becomes really unpleasant. On each occasion when people have been gassed and chemical weapons have been used against people, we have known whose side we were on, and we have always in the past stood up for the oppressed. So it goes without saying that that's quite unsound rhetoric, but it does tell us something about the way in which Holocaust remembrance has been kind of distorted in the UK and has become a kind of celebration of Britishness in a really problematic way. And there are lots of other sort of distortive elements about the way in which we think about the Holocaust, and it comes from the way in which we're encouraged to remember. So one of the things we're encouraged to remember is that, and I quote again from the report that I mentioned before, the Holocaust was the planned, systematic, industrialised murder of 6 million Jewish men, women and children during the Second World War. It's the first time in history that plans were put in place to annihilate every member of a particular race or people. The problem with that narrative is it's not really correct in any meaningful sense. It aligns together lots of different complex historical events, from people who were killed under, in ghetto conditions, people who were murdered by their neighbours in various different countries across Eastern Europe, but it reduces it to this very simple to understand plan of a kind of nasty government of which Britain was at war with. And so what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that some of the controlling assumptions of the of Holocaust remembrance are at best distortions. So what really then are people being asked to remember? In some ways the answer is nothing, because they're being asked to embrace what is ultimately a fiction. And I have no doubt that it was not the intention of those who campaigned for greater recognition of the Holocaust in the 1980s and 90s. It's not really the intention of some of those organisations which campaign on Holocaust education and remembrance today, that this wasn't their intention. Their sense was that the Holocaust should be disrupted, that remembrance should help us ask awkward questions. But I think that they're wrong. So the challenge, it seems to me, about remembrance and the sort of when remembrance and education come together, is it seems to raise the rather odd spectre that remembrance might not be about remembrance at all, but about forgetting. So that applies in its own terms, and I've tried to give you some examples of the way how the Holocaust is remembered in a slightly distorted manner. It doesn't have room for more complex historical realities, doesn't have room for the kind of complex history and meaning-making that people have been talking about today. And then, of course, it also applies for the past that we don't remember explicitly, and the past that somehow are obscured because of the attention that is given through remembrance events to past like the Holocaust, and in some senses the Great War would come into that category as well. And one of those things that is not remembered, of course, are Britain's own colonial crimes and colonial violence, which it doesn't feature in really in the sort of memorial landscape, the rhetoric of remembrance in the UK. But I'm not going to talk about that because that's an entirely other story. So I will leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great kick off with some positive thoughts. Right, David Aldred and Susanna Wright.
Susanna Wright on behalf of David, plus some others.
Okay.
Yeah. David couldn't make it today, which may be just as well given the size of the size of the room and our capacity. I'm aiming for a very smooth transition here. And there we go. So, remembrance in schools. So, I'm here, as you can see, on behalf of a large project team at Oxford Brookes and Brunel Universities, and we're looking at remembrance in schools. Our particular focus, running from 2013 to 19, has actually been on armistice commemoration in schools. Something that all schools do is that suffocating period, as we have just heard, and that comes out a little bit in our data, I must admit. But it's received actually very little research attention in the school context, so there we are. We work with primary and secondary schools across Oxfordshire, Berkshire and Buckinghamshire. We're a multidisciplinary research team. We've done online surveys, and we have done interviews this March as well. And we're hoping to move on to some observations and, as I said earlier, some questionnaires. Be that a provocative idea or not. So in the few minutes I have available, I'll just have a little bit of a flavour of what teachers felt they're doing when they are asking their schools to engage in this active remembrance of World War I in the school context. So one of the things that we asked was, what is being remembered in Armistice commemorations? And the World Wars are prominent. So are poppies, so are silence, so are lots of other things. But the World Wars come through prominently. In the interviews, teachers talked about the World Wars being part of the Armistice tradition. So poppies and the 2 minute silence, they had their roots in the First World War, they continued through the Second, and so on. And both of these poppies and the 2 minute silence were practically ubiquitous as features of schools' Armistice commemorations. So it's important to say as well that the two wars kind of get conflated in teachers' comments quite a lot, and I'll say a little bit more about that. So what are the sort of narratives that teachers were putting across in what they were doing for their pupils in this? And the language they use is about remembrance rather than memory, and that may be a distinction to make. But this is where remembrance and education come together with perhaps some of the messiness that's been alluded to already. So the first one, it's connecting with our past and our identity. There is some reference to common British identity and values, but questions were raised about the commonality of our past in schools with many nationalities, ethnic groups and faiths. Teachers in these schools noted the need for sensitivity and accepting of different stories. Involvement in events that went beyond the school were deemed a way to tap into these wider connections, but as we talked about these wider events, maybe that's... maybe there are some sort of problematic aspects there. We've also heard a lot about making it personal this morning, and that came through very strongly in the sort of things that teachers were talking about as well. So they wanted to make their remembrance events something that would help pupils associate conflicts with ordinary people and actual people. So visits were arranged from veterans in schools that had proximity to military bases. It could be current serving personnel who came in, or it could be kind of older members of the local community who'd come in and tell their stories. So again, these are strategies that we've heard about in different contexts today. In the secondary school context, the second quote shows, old boys became very important. So roles of honour would be read out. The idea is that it's quite kind of important for pupils to realise that their predecessors, who were standing in the same place as them, using the same buildings and so on, could have been them called up, and some of them died. So we had that narrative. There's an emphasis as well on family and community, and again, these are strategies that we've heard about before. Children bringing in things from home, children talking to their relatives, or searching for names of local and community people on gravestones and so on. The teachers as well were actually motivated to build these personal links. This wasn't a question we asked, but it kind of came out in the discussions. So a lot of them were either kind of historians by background, that might have been what they studied, so the history was important to them, or they remembered their own family stories of engagement in the war, and that's why what made them think it was important, and why they wanted to give up their time and actually get involved in a research project with us. So the narrative around remembrance commemoration overwhelmingly emphasised military service as the story about the schools. It was about remembering and honouring those who fought in the wars, the sacrifices they made, the freedom. These are all things we've heard before today as well. Most interviews mentioned present conflicts as well as the World Wars. So it was often, it's about the World Wars mainly and other conflicts. That was the sort of format that was given. We did get some mention about the impact of the wars on communities and families, but to a much lesser extent. And that came particularly from schools that actually had current pupils, very international-based schools where current pupils came from war zones, and perhaps that element became important. there is an emphasis on learning from the past for a better future. And this is the way it was sort of phrased. Plenty of variations, which are quite nuanced, on the theme of remembering war to work for peace in the future. It was sort of something that was a project of citizenship as well. So remembering the wars was something that would help people make informed decisions as citizens later. They'd spot the signs, so there were discussions about the current rise of hyper-nationalism and so on, and pupils needing to look back and know how to see what might happen and take responsibility for it, so there was that sort of language coming through. And then finally, and this came through particularly in a primary school context, almost a kind of therapeutic approach to it. It's a vehicle for dealing with loss and death. And I'm remembering the discussion about the use of remembrance or the tools in the prison context as a way of sort of dealing with difficult issues, but in a safe way. So it's a way of bringing these difficult situations into the school environment, and then after the actual commemorative event has happened, pupils can talk to their teachers about their family, their goldfish, whatever their issue is. But there is the idea in the primary school context, again, of not scaring pupils too much, but also being kind of realistic enough. There's a very interesting mention of the role of the silence and the fact that it was a good thing for four-year-olds in reception class to actually be doing this. So part of it was about showing respect in an appropriate manner and so on. But part of it also was that it gave pupils the tools to be able to be thoughtful in a way that would help them deal with these more difficult emotions. So, yeah, there's this kind of educational imperative behind the commemoration for the teachers as well. So I'll close quickly with that. How am I doing?
You're doing fine.
Good. So some thoughts. What do we make of all this? Teachers repeatedly noted the passing of the generation effectively directly affected or involved, and again that's been mentioned several times today. So the way we're thinking about it, we're not really actually talking about a collective memory, but we're talking about deliberate collective remembrance. It's a socially constructed thing. It's active and it's intentional. In the school context at least, collective remembrance is educational, and that's where David Aldridge's kind of previous work comes in a bit. And that very much comes through in what teachers thought they were trying to achieve when we talked to them for their pupils. So remembrance is done with particular purposes and with particular readings and uses of the past. And perhaps as interviewees, we can see sort of some of the inconsistencies and nuances with them. Some of the interviewees could as well. They kept on kind of backtracking, wondering what they were trying to achieve, wondering if some of the aims were a little contradictory. The teachers we spoke to came nowhere near glorifying military conflict in an unthinking way, and we can't emphasise that enough. A number of them, in a sense, distanced themselves from that type of remembrance and commemoration. But the commemorations were very much about military service and not the home front. And what was missing in all but one case was any reference to conscientious objection, to peace movements and objections to war, and that sort of thing. Why is this? Is it our self-selected sample of teachers? We're thinking this is probably about the nature of the kind of rituals of remembrance themselves, which bring a particular reading. One of our teachers put it this way: we talk about this stuff, but in the history classroom and assemblies, it's not appropriate to talk about these other views when we're actually involved in Remembrance Day. So now we want to see what comes out in the observations, the schools and the interviewees, where perhaps we'll get our perspective and we'll get the pupils, questionnaires and pupils' perspectives too.
There you go.
Thank
you.
Thank you very much. So our next speaker is Rihanna.
Just one second, I'm just going to get something up for the end.
Wherever you want to go.
Can you
sit?
Yeah, I'm going to sit. Can I squeeze past you?
Yeah,
Just to say, first of all, thank you for inviting me here. It's been really great to take part in this, and I've learned so much already today, so thank you. So I'm Rhianna, I work at Porter's Watch. If you've not heard of us, which you probably haven't, we're a really small organisation, and we look at militarism in the UK, so we study it and we advocate about it. We conduct research and we work with political parties and the media. One of the things that we do is we scrutinise the ethics of armed forces recruitment practices, so the recruitment of under 18-year-olds in the UK, for example. We also advocate for greater transparency in MOD decision-making. So, for example, currently there's this sort of drive to extend combat immunity so that it applies not just for decisions made on the battlefield, but also decisions made at Whitehall, which would mean that the Ministry of Defence sort of becomes its own judge and jury, and just like inquiries are conducted behind closed doors. So that's the kind of thing that we look at. What I want to share with you today is just some thoughts on increasing militarism in the UK, which is something that we feel is happening, and how that might impact on how wars are taught, remembered and understood by young people. And just open that up to you as well for your thoughts. So in the past decade, a sort of loose range of politicians, military leaders, newspapers and pressure groups have been working with a variety of different, sometimes conflicting agendas to increase public and political support for the British Armed Forces and their operations. Some would call this militarisation. There's lots of different views on what militarisation actually consists of. I'll be talking about it here in terms of the promotion of the military's values and power. This sort of escalation coincided with the unpopular, coincided with the unpopular escalation of Britain's involvement in Afghanistan, which was going on at the same time as the ongoing unpopular war in Iraq. So there was this sort of need to increase public support for the armed forces and what they were doing. And there have been lots of different elements to this phenomenon of militarisation. Obviously, I want to look specifically at how this has happened or how this might have been happening in education and civil society, with the intention to raise the power and prestige of the military in those spaces and from those spaces, as well as sort of easing the army's perennial recruitment problems by raising their profile within those spaces. I want to note, because I think it's relevant for some of the conversations that we've been having today, that some of this militarisation process has involved the promotion of a kind of conservative assimilationist British nationalism as a means of dealing with sort of existential threats. So, for example, you had the former head of the armed forces, General Sir Richard Dannett, and former Prime Minister David Cameron attacking multiculturalism and arguing for a stronger assertion of assimilationist nationalism, including greater British self-confidence about our imperial past. And I think that's very interesting. So in this view, the military becomes a sort of model and school for the nation. Through the military, you promote conservative values like discipline, loyalty, sacrifice, and integration through national assimilation. In 2015, so more recently, the current head of the British Army, General Sir Nicholas Carter, claimed that the army had an increasing role to play at home in terms of trying to integrate our society. So in what are generally seen as wars of choice rather than of national survival, militarisation is key in order to win over the hearts and minds of the public to support the war. So the home front becomes the front line. The Ministry of Defence saw a multicultural Britain as responsible for resistance to seeing troops deployed in countries from which those British citizens once came from or their families came from. And so assimilationism and militarism become really vital tools for the war effort, as it were. How long do I have?
You have about 4 more minutes.
Okay. Okay. I was gonna run through the 12 core tenets of militarism according to Bernazzoli and Flint, but I'll leave that to you to look up because I don't have time to do that. But I would just note that a decline in direct experience of the military can lead to an increase in militarism. So that's something quite interesting for us in this century, where we don't have conscription. Britain's political culture now seems far less tolerant of critical voices of the military than it did in the 20th century, when more people, more civilians, had direct experience of the military. there are lots of ways in which militarism is advancing in education in the UK, including increasing ties between the armed forces, arms corporations, and other industries as well, and educational institutions. In 2007, Prime Minister Gordon Brown published a review where he identified ways of encouraging greater understanding and appreciation of the armed forces by the British public. And he argued that the military could only operate with maximum motivation and effectiveness if they were morally and materially supported by the society they are defending. And many of these 40 recommendations were implemented. They're not the only ones, things like that. But in terms of education, that's included the expansion of the combined cadet forces, which is really, really increasing in state schools, putting military topics in the national curriculum and bringing the military into schools in various different ways with various different curriculum links. It was really great to hear Esther this morning talking about her work with young people and how that's free, because one of the things that's concerned us is the massive cuts to youth services across the UK since 2011 and maybe before, while £95 million of money has gone into military programs targeting young people. So the options for young people are often much more limited. So it's great to hear of different things that encourage critical thinking and that sort of thing. Natalia Davalova argues that the promotion of British values in schools since 2007 has opened the door to the militarisation of British secondary school education. She writes, "This militarisation has been developing first through initiatives in citizenship and remembrance, and second through the direct intervention of the military institutions in the education system." So just looking very briefly at war remembrance and how militarisation might be impacting this, which is more, I would say, concerns that we have, and then we open it up to you and people who are practising to tell us whether or not this is the case and whether or not, you know, there are more things that we should be talking about and doing. But certainly politically, the commemoration of the First World War has been linked to forging patriotic feelings. In 2008, the MOD did offer advice to teachers on what to teach in history lessons. There are free resources and lesson plans offered by the Ministry of Defence to primary and secondary schools, but which some of my colleagues might talk a bit more about, maybe. I want to highlight, I think we've touched on this a bit, that in the last 20 years, the commemoration of the war dead has been used to promote nationalism, militarised citizenship and support for war. Again, Natalia Danilova, she argues that war commemoration is decontextualised and depoliticised, and that the moral complexity of war is replaced by the uncompromising call of support. So while I think we can see a deliberate sort of reinventing of Armistice Day for political motivations, and we've got this sort of shifting where it's not just the world wars that we're commemorating, but also more recent and current and ongoing military operations, and you also have, among a huge swathe of young people, a lack of understanding, historical understanding of the differences between these wars and the huge complexities involved in them. And this is something that does concern us, and we're concerned that remembrance is being used to mobilise support for current wars in a way that's really, really worrying, I think. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've done as an organisation is we worked with David Aldridge on a paper that he published, a sort of philosophy of education paper on how remembrance is taught in schools, and we used that to produce, because not a lot of teachers are going to read a really massive big paper on one thing, so we produced a kind of smaller resource based on that, which is called Rethinking Remembrance, and that was last year in November. I don't have copies of it to give to you, but if you went onto forceswatch.net, you'll see the resource Rethinking Remembrance, and I'd really love feedback and comments and criticisms. It's something that we would edit, that we'd update, and do kind of come back to us with your thoughts. That would be really great. I have a couple of questions that I just want to finish with. One is, how might history teachers and educators and people involved in this area respond to the militarisation of society and education? What are some things that you can do if you wanted to respond to that? There are lots of other things that I wanted to, I could have brought in, like the Armed Forces Community and Corporate Covenants that have come out in recent years, new events like Armed Forces Day. There's so many different ways in which we're seeing more and more of a military presence in schools, and also arms company presence in schools as well. And how might this impact on new generations and how they think about history, how they think about the wars, and how they are able to critique current conflicts or future conflicts that we might be involved in. So those are some questions that I have. I want to just really quickly finish by pointing to this and saying that I'm going to this tonight. I'm quite excited. It's the closing night of Art the Arms Fair. For some of you may know already, but this week is the biggest arms fair in the world in London, DCEI. And there's been a week of art exhibition from artists, some of whom are from war zones like Yemen, one of whom is Banksy, sort of contributing art to this exhibition in London. It's the closing night tonight. So go on that website for more information.
Thank you. Sorry, good podium. Okay, so our next speaker is Ellis Brooks from the Point of View Foundation.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for that segue, Rena, because I think it's a good example of how history is being written right now. So part of my job in the last couple of weeks has been to support Quakers who were taking action at the arms fair. So yesterday I got an early morning call to tell me that a guy called David, who is in his late 80s, he uses a mobility scooter, had rocked up at London's Excel Centre with a D-lock, some super glue and two companions, and was now being jumbled into a police van with them for obstructing the entrance where the arms dealers and the arms buyers were entering. So that's part of the Quaker peace witness, which goes back to the 17th century. Just give me with the intensity of your jazz hands, let me know how much you know about Quakers already. So this is like nothing, and that's like everything. Go. Okay, that's a reasonable amount. Cool. So I won't go too heavy, but there is the well-loved quote that while Quakers don't have like a dogma or a single doctrine, that they do collect things that have been said over centuries. So one of them is this: search out in your own way of life whatever may contain the seeds of war. And the work that Brianna's just been describing is kind of looking at that at a societal level. I think that's what Forces Watch is doing, and that's what Quakers are seeking to. As you said, my job is peace education, which I find a very joyful thing to do. I can train young people in conflict resolution sort of approaches. I can help them explore mindfulness and sort of an inner peace level, which I think we're sort of linking to that moment of silence. But like, why 1 minute of silence in the year? Like, is that our investment in inner peace for young people? But then there's also this concern that Quakers have brought of the increasing militarisation of society. And I'm not an academic and I don't have a paper, but my brilliant colleague Sam Walton a few years ago wrote this, The New Tide of Militarisation. So that is the kind of the critique and, if you like, the where it puts together the smoking gun of what Rihanna was describing. Like, this is, it's not an accidental kind of osmosis in society, at least not totally. There is a deliberate government strategy to foreground military values, and Quakers would argue that is to support the institution of war itself. So it's quite a quixotic thing to try and challenge, because like, what is militarism? And that's something that we'd actually like to discuss with young people. It's not just one to have at an academic kind of meta-educational level, but like, what do young people understand by that? And is that a lens that you can explore the history of war through? So I mentioned I do conflict resolution training with young people. One manifestation of that is peer mediation. Again, just jazz hands. If you know what peer mediation is, show me. Okay, that was a bit weaker than the Quaker one. So peer mediation is conflict resolution for young people by young people. So you have young people who are trained to mediate for other children in the school in conflict. And it's amazing. I think I would take a 10-year-old mediator over a 40-year-old mediator any day of the week. But once you've got those skills, they're applicable to lots of different situations. So a role play I love to do in schools is you've got two characters, red and white. And here's red. Well, it was a very solemn occasion. I arrived in the square, in the memorial, and lo and behold, white was just sitting there brazenly on the memorial already. Doesn't she know what day it is? And then white's like, well, I was just hanging out, man. Chill out. I'm totes peaceful. And then that leads into a mediation between red and white about who should have access to the space of a war memorial on the 11th of November. Who does that belong to? And in so doing that, they're learning about those different perspectives without you saying, you know, in a deontological, dogmatic way, this is the right way to think about it. Like, why does someone want to wear a red poppy? What are they valuing? But at the same time, Jan's been saying, there is a deliberate, I think, co-optation of the remembrance narrative. Because it's pretty handy because of the taboos. You can utilise that to suffocate debate and genuine critical education. So how do we challenge that? It is things that everyone in this room, I think, is pretty conversant in. It is developing critical thinking, it is personalising it, it is thinking about identity, it is looking a step further back each time. But there's also the institution of the school and what their take on this is. And it's really heartening to hear that teachers are not kind of buying that kind of militarism in their discourse, in their outputs. But if you're a head teacher and you're offered a free stall, a free workshop from your local armed forces to develop career skills, or if you're invited to your children are invited to a local base to do some activities, or why not, we'll just send someone in and they'll do some fun team building activities in your school. There's no cost, it's a path of least resistance, and you'll be able to sell it to your parents, like, it's exciting, it's fun, it's team building, it's discipline. So it's pitched as a solution to lots of problems for schools, and it's very well subsidised, so why would they say no to it? Because a school deserves balance when discussing a controversial issue, and war is a controversial issue because you will get different views on it. The 1996 Education Act says schools should make sure that there are balanced views, but if you're only giving that military voice that privileged space, then you're not getting balanced views. I also think there's a safety dimension, like a valuing of life, in that we know that young people, particularly those under 18 recruits that Brianna mentioned, face very poor outcomes when they go through the armed forces. So, it's not good for your health, mentally or physically, or for your career prospects in later life. There's good research from MEDACT, I think, which Brianna also worked for previously, that will bear that out. So that's the kind of honesty and information that young people should be supplied with. And there's a very good website called Before You Sign Up that I would hope every careers advisor in every school would make sure young people see, because it gives the information that the Army or the Navy or the Air Force would not give you about what might happen in the armed forces, just the facts and what their rights are. There's one more thing I'd like to mention.
1 minute.
Which is this. The Inspire Peace Charter. So this is kind of an interesting tension for me, because I'd like to go in all schools and do sort of very critical thinking-y, like interactive workshops, but because we want to address that unit of a school and their decision making, we want a tool that a teacher, a pupil, an activist could take to that school and say, what are your commitments on this? And this commits a school to peace education, and there'll be lots of events that this will culminate in around Remembrance 2018. So there'll be events in cathedrals and mosques and synagogues all around the UK in November 2018, on the 9th of November, for young people to take part in, for schools to participate in. But in signing up to this charter that's kind of part of the build-up to that, among many things to do with peace education, the school commits to an individual being involved in this charter would commit to playing their part with others to prevent war and violence around the world. Is that too normative for you guys? I'm not sure. And they also pledge to explore the root causes of violence, as well as to ensure that balanced views are presented to our young people about war, the military, armed violence, conflict resolution, and peace building. So that's something that we're hoping schools will actively sign up to from a sort of grassroots movement, so that this debate, this balance does happen. Cheers.
Okay, hello everyone. Yeah, as you've heard, my name is Owen and I am from CND Peace Education, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament Peace Education Programme. And I'm just giving out leaflets, if you wouldn't mind, that would be amazing. Thanks very much. So they'll give you a summary of our work. And I do also have a presentation of this week as well. So basically, since 2005, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which many of you will be aware of, campaigns against nuclear weapons, primarily in the UK but also around the world, has also run an education programme. And it's very important to underline the distinction of the education programme from the campaigning body of CND. So whereas they obviously are political and trying to influence people's opinions, we are committed to impartiality. When we go into schools, when we produce resources, we're always exploring different points of view and ultimately focusing on facilitating young people's critical thinking skills, as others mentioned. And that is something that we're very dedicated to, and that's borne out, for example, in the fact that we are funded by a charity called the Nuclear Education Trust, as opposed to CND or CND members. So there's quite a big separation there, whilst we obviously have links. Just give me a second whilst I bring this up. Yeah, so we look at nuclear weapons issues and related issues of peace and security. So it's a very broad kind of scope that we have, but obviously the specific focus on nuclear weapons is quite a niche thing. And a big part of this, unsurprisingly, is the history of nuclear weapons, which obviously is a very recent history, particularly in terms of the long view of history. And today I'll talk a little bit about the Second World War kind of learning that we encourage when we do stuff. So what do we do specifically? We offer free cross-curricular active learning sessions to schools and also resources to teachers. And that's in England, not Scotland, elsewhere. We leave that to other bodies. So we focus on England, and we have quite a lot of take-up. So we have distributed, for example, 30,000 hard copies of our teaching packs. We've got five teaching packs at the moment, and we've had well over 85,000 downloads of those. We encounter 3,000 to 4,000 students in schools each year, primarily secondary schools, but also some colleges, also some primary schools. We also do teacher training sessions, primarily for new teachers during PGCE years in particular, but also sometimes a CPD for kind of more experienced teachers. And that focuses on how to look at controversial issues in the classroom appropriately and effectively, which is something we see ourselves as having something of a specialisation in. We're highly regarded. Without sort of over-egging it, we've got a lot of recommendations from test resources, Times Education Supplement. Currently four of our resources on their website are test picks, kind of have the test pick status. We have two of our five teaching packs with the quality mark of the Association for Citizenship Teaching, and we hope to have the others get that status in the near future. And we have overwhelmingly positive feedback from students and teachers when we go in to deliver our sessions. So most of them say it was either extremely or very engaging and they'd like to have us back to do another session. So we're pleased with what we do. Obviously, we want to improve, always. You can find out more either in the leaflets, go on our website, ask me afterwards. So I'll leave that there in terms of what we do. Just show you an image to give you a bit of a visual sense of it. So the main thing I want to talk about now is how do schools and colleges students engage with the parts of our sessions that centre on the Second World War. And I'll try and make a few points regarding collective or cultural memory that kind of arise from that. And this is primarily based on my 9 months in post, so it's anecdotal to an extent, but we've also got some sort of more qualitative data that I'm drawing from. So all of our main workshops and our assembly talk that we deliver in schools have some aspect that looks at the US nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. So we always include that. Sometimes it's very cursory, sometimes it is the focus of the session. And to give you an illustration of one of our teaching packs and associated resources that focuses on it, it's called Truman on Trial. And among the lessons of that teaching pack, the kind of flagship lesson is a mock trial that the students host in the classroom of President Truman. Was he justified or not in authorising the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? So the students take on the roles of jurors, barristers, and witnesses. So there's an element of role play. They look at some primary historical sources. If they're a high ability group, they might also look at some secondary sources. And it's obviously a really dynamic, kind of collaborative lesson, which always goes very, very well. And you can see some images from that It's actually undergoing an update at the moment, so we're going to incorporate some new material, including the relatively little known role of Britain and specifically Winston Churchill in that decision to drop the bombs. So first of all, the British research that kind of preceded the Manhattan Project, the development of the nuclear bombs, and then the fact that Britain, at least on paper, had a veto on a decision to use the nuclear bombs, and Winston Churchill gave Britain's consent, as he put it, unhesitatingly. So that's quite an interesting element, and we've heard a lot today, haven't we, about bringing it home to the students, making it more relevant. So in sessions in England, it's nice to be able to say, well, this is Britain's kind of involvement as well, what do you think of that? Not just the kind of distant, this was America and Japan. So just some images to give you a sense of that. So this is the kind of thing we look at. We look at lots of video clips as well. I would say in pretty much every session we deliver, there's always at least one student, and sometimes many more, who know something about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I've never encountered a group that hasn't. I was doing sessions for year 3 and 4, say 7 to 9 year olds last week, and some of them knew actually quite a bit. So there's kind of a base understanding, which you could call a sort of form of collective memory. And I would estimate very kind of speculatively that perhaps 20% of young people, and it might well be more, know something of those bombings, and some of them know a lot. And I should give a shout out here to Anna Liddell in the audience, now at Leeds Beckett University, who used to do my job at CND Peace Education, and great credit to her for actually creating this pack and a lot of the others. And it'd be interesting to hear if she sort of has similar experience to me on what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the time. Another session I would like to point out is called Sadako's Cranes for Peace, and this looks at the experience of a young girl, Sadako Sasaki, who survived the Hiroshima bombing but later died of leukemia, almost definitely caused by exposure to the radiation of the bomb. And before she died, and she's now a sort of worldwide symbol for peace or reconciliation, before she died, she, according to the probably more likely story, folded 1,000 origami peace cranes, perhaps in a wish, in an attempt to have a wish or good fortune, because in Japan, 1,000 cranes are associated with good fortune. And just to give you a sense of that session, as I delivered it in the primary school last week, a lot of it was focused on what is peace, what peace symbols do you know? So it was going very broad before then honing in to what is a nuclear bomb, and then here's the story of Sadako. What's Japan, where's Japan, etc., etc. So it's very cross-curricular, as you can see. Is that 2 minutes? Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I would say young people tend to know more about Hiroshima and Nagasaki than about the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, despite the far greater likelihood that their parents, grandparents, etc., had personal experience of the latter. So I would say that they're more likely to have that as general knowledge. And I would say, in fact, they're more likely to know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki than they are about the UK's possession of nuclear weapons and the history of that, which is quite striking. But obviously, given the extensive media coverage of tensions between North Korea and the US and others over the last 9 months or so, there's been quite a shift. So even as opposed to a year ago, students are much more aware of nuclear weapons issues and the kind of international relations that goes with that, which is very interesting for us and gives us a real springboard when we're going into schools. Just a few reflections from a very insightful Washington Post article from 2015. They basically asked users of the social media platform Reddit, how is the Hiroshima atomic bomb taught in your country? It had over 2,500 comments, and the common themes were, according to the article, that the bombing was only a smaller part of the World War II learning, and sometimes it wasn't even looked at all. That the bombing saved lives by ending the war more quickly and without a land invasion, that it was perhaps unnecessary, especially the subsequent bombing of Nagasaki, and that the United States wanted to send a message to the rest of the world that it was the start of the Cold War. So some really interesting differences there. And there's been some analysis of how it's taught in different countries, revealing a lot of bias, particularly in the 90s in the US and Japan. Both countries had, you know, very particular points of view. However, a more recent study suggests that in the US, I don't know about Japan, it's become more nuanced, the teaching. Interestingly, I met a survivor of the Hiroshima bombing earlier this year, and she said to me, a lot of young people in Japan don't know anything about it, which I was really surprised by, but there you go. And to conclude, the Washington Post article had one comment from, or highlighted one comment from a UK individual, and it was a secondary school teacher, and I'd like to quote them, just because their perspective is very similar to that of C&D Peace Education. They said, "I like to use it, the Hiroshima bombing, as an example to develop the students' argument formation. It's usually taught as a standalone lesson with the topic, was the dropping of the atomic bombs justified? Give the kids evidence, give them reports, accounts, and let them make up their own mind." I think that's basically spot on. That's what we should be doing, and that's what we try to do in C&D Peace Education. So thanks very much for listening. I'll be very happy to answer any questions about any of that afterwards.
Either a particular speaker or perhaps a broader question or comment that the panel can respond to. So, does anybody want to kick off? I've got two, so start here and then back. So, you go first.
Really interesting. As somebody that studies video games, obviously, video games are notoriously militaristic. Shooters are currently the biggest genre. And yet, they actually are a really good example of teaching kids about the problems. So we use it as the, how many of you play Battlefield 1, blah, 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 and all our students are like, yeah, no. But then you can start showing them things like, they're not aware that, you know, some of that game is funded by arms manufacturing licensing. They're not aware of the historical context. And you can start teaching that, but they're also not aware that, you know, the American military uses a game as a recruitment tool. So games can actually be, even when they're incredibly militaristic, you can actually use them to demonstrate the lesser known narratives. But I mean, also, most game developers, if you look closely enough, there's a lot of stories and narratives that are anti-war in these games, and yet they get missed because we're not teaching games in that. You know, if you're an English teacher and you're teaching All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, that's core text, people read it, you know, there's a clear message, it's understood. If the kids are going home and playing Battlefield 1 and they're not aware of the narratives that are going on underneath, it's just, and this you get the argument of, it's just a game.
Yeah.
Mm.
Does anybody want to respond?
Just say something quickly, is that okay? Yeah, I think it's really vital that we engage with young people in that specific area. But what's really interesting is that, like you were saying, the military and arms companies are doing exactly the same thing. They are very engaged in it, and they're very much utilising it as a tool to promote their agenda.
There are some games companies that are at that arms fair.
Yes, yeah, I know.
Right? Because they are selling the development of simulations and tools in order to fund their game development.
Yeah. I think there's using the people's experience of games that might be seen to promote violence to have a discussion about that, and to have a discussion about the various different industries that are involved, and, you know, kind of like wider conversations about it, which actually they probably find really interesting to do that. But there's also, there are games that, like you were saying, that don't kind of follow that same pattern. I mean, I can't remember the name of it, but I've heard about a game which is to do with refugees fleeing from conflict zones.
This War of Mine.
So
it's based on the Sarajevo siege.
Yeah. So I mean, there are alternatives. There was an army recruitment video. Owen might know more about this than me. That actually used used the video game format, and it was like a mini kind of recruitment video, but it was a video game.
War Child did exactly the same as a kind of riposte. So they actually used that gaming interface as for the shock value. So I mean, there's loads of crossover.
Yeah.
You know, we have anti-war films, we have anti-war novels, we have anti-war comics. We don't seem to have that many anti-war games.
Yeah.
And yet it's a medium that's being used.
I think it's not even just about being anti-war necessarily. I think it's about thinking critically about what you're seeing, what you're doing, and recognising that it's not all one sort of glorious sacrificial quest. That's more the position that I would come from, is that it's dangerous to morph everything into one and to think of it in with that one sort of very nationalist perspective. And I think that some of the violence that we see on screens, not just in games, does glorify violence and does normalise it in some ways.
I'd agree. And yeah, so it's the dominant medium either now or soon, isn't it? I think yes. Gaming. So yes. We went from novel to movie to that. It's, so
you know, I work in the field, and it scares me when we talk about Dunkirk, and Dunkirk brought in almost $500 million box office over global release, mm-hmm. and that was the same amount of money that Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 brought in the first day.
Wow.
Right? And yet we're not, I don't think people necessarily realise how this medium is dominating, and we see it because we get 200 something students every year coming to want to make games. Mm-hmm. And it's reflective of what they want to make, the things that they're playing, but it's also, it's scary because they don't necessarily have that vision of things. And
The one other thing I'd mention in that context is drone warfare. So we're in playing a computer game. War actually is becoming playing a computer game. So things are merging.
Some colleagues of mine created a game called Killbox. If you Google it, it'll come up. Which you play as one person plays as a drone operator, one person plays as a child playing on a Afghanistan farm. You're not a child, you're a ball, because it's all abstract. But you obviously play to the logical conclusion, and it's incredibly impactful. But
can you share that with?
It's available to download. It's free.
I think we another question in the back. It was a really interesting discussion, and I'm sure we could go on. But Jason had a question.
There's a danger that we leave this room really gloomy. and I share the concern of what the panelists are about, the political motivations of the state and stuff like that. But in terms of remembrance, in terms of militarisation and stuff like that, but I think there's a danger of over-determining that just because that's what the state wants the kids to think, that is what they are going to think. And that's partly, I gave out some of my epigraphic portraits at the beginning, and kids were really, there's lots of ambivalences that they expressed around Poppies about remembrance and stuff like that, so I think that's really important. But I don't want to detract from it. I still think I'm really worried when I share that concern. Because the thing that I felt about young people is that when they were allowed the opportunity, there's a real willingness to actually talk and debate and things like that. So I think the key issue is about how do you enable teachers in schools to create those spaces to have those types of discussion. Yeah. And just in a couple of contexts around that, University of Hull and I think the NASUWT just did a report on teachers' attitudes towards the prevent agenda. Very recent, it's just come out, and it's about how teachers are now just sort of saying, well, we can't do anything about it. It's like a passive acceptance of it. Yeah. And that's got to be seen in a broader context of, accountability, etc., etc., etc. And it's just a sort of last thing, Tom talked about the IOE students' report. Well, preceding that was the teachers' report, and about what teachers and the Holocaust is all about. And one of the things they sort of said is that a lot of teachers' knowledge is they're drawing on popular culture themselves. How do you enable teachers to draw beyond popular culture in the teaching of the Holocaust? The other concern, and it just opens it up to the whole panel, is there's a sort of concern that they express. I might be misquoting them, but they were talking about how teachers were prioritising civic-based aims over history-specific teaching, and how that, so they weren't teaching the Holocaust as a historical phenomenon. They were teaching it as a moral lesson. Now, I just wonder how far the panel think that actually civic aims are and should be foregrounded, or if there are any problems of not seeing some of these historical events as historically specific events.
Can I just please answer the first point that you were making about remembrance and not leaving here, without feeling gloomy? I think one of the really important things, it seems to me, and it goes back to one of the other presentations we were talking about, what's being remembered and why, and all of those questions, is actually just one of the most important things that one could give to young people in the context of this is simply the notion that remembrance is itself historically contingent, right? Yes. So that actually it is not eternal. that actually we can talk about how we remember, what the form of remembrance should be, and that is a thing that we do debate, and also that it has changed, right? So my children remember in a very different way to I did when I was at school, right? And I remembered in a very different way to that which had been in the 1960s. And we know that remembrance is itself a kind of, you know, historical phenomena that we can understand historically. And I think that's really important, because that is something where I think that it is presented in a kind of eternal fashion. I think the other point that you made about, you know, the tension between historical education and education for citizenship is a tension that we are kind of locked into. And in around Holocaust education, it's probably more pronounced than anywhere else. But it is disturbing in that sense, and something that, you know, requires navigating around. But I've lost my articulacy, partly because I'm conscious that my train is leaving very soon, so I'm going to get up at that point.
I was just going to respond very, very briefly to that point, again, about not being too gloomy. And so whereas teachers were sort of voicing a lot of the dominant cultural narratives and so on around the armistice, they were also being very, very responsive to the needs of their students and their schools, and were articulating those quite closely, quite carefully. And we're obviously talking a lot to students in reviewing, creating, and so on, their memorial rituals. And obviously having those, having difficult conversations in some form or another, if not in the commemoration itself. So I think you've got two things going on. You do have a broader cultural narrative, and of course it affects everything. But you've also got teachers and pupils as individuals responding in quite articulate and critical ways, but imbibing some of it. It's a difficult one.
Which was the case 100 years ago as well.
Exactly.
yes, please. Richard,
just in response to the second question, sort of, or try to address it. So I mentioned that CNDP's education aim to deliver very cross-curricular sessions, but having said that, we also, within our packs, separate out specific subject lessons. So, for example, in that Truman on Trial pack, we have an RE lesson that explores just war theory, starting off with the kids without having looked at just war theory, developing their own rules of war, what would be a just reason to go to war, and what would be reasonable things, in inverted commas, to do within a war. Then they look at just war theory, compare it, and then they look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and compare both sets of conditions to that and decide whether it was ultimately, you know, just or not. And likewise, we have a citizenship one, which is more about media analysis and looking at bias in the media. But even within those, it always ends up being very cross-curricular, because any attempt to obviously explore nuclear weapons in the contemporary context involves going way back to where they come from, you know, what has informed the current country's policies, etc., etc. I think I do see that there's a potential danger. And it was interesting you both sort of said something along the lines of history and citizenship and where they're meeting and how separate should they, and how wary should we be about it. But for me, like, they are ultimately intertwined so much anyway.
You've been patient, Richard. Some
of what I wanted to say was about what Tom had said, but I'll say it anyway because it's relevant to the discussion. Clearly, the militarisation in the way that it happens in schools and has happened for the last 15 years or so is hugely problematic. I would say often when the military are in schools, they're actually promoting critical thinking.
Sometimes
that may not sound obvious to people, but for example, the thing I showed about Hemel at War, when two ex-students came in and talked about Iraq and Afghanistan, they themselves were absolutely clear that wars were justified. But the dominant school of thought among sixth formers was that these wars were wrong and they should have no part of it. And they were suitably challenged by saying, yeah, I can't walk anymore, I'm now in a wheelchair, but I don't think we should pull out. That would make it really futile. So the military, you know, there's a lot of sophisticated thinking that goes on at Sandhurst, and, you know, the military just doesn't want to fight all the time. In fact, a lot of the time they want to avoid it. I very much recognise the points that people made about the sort of stultifying atmosphere of remembrance. I mean, curiously, as a First World War historian, I feel really alienated from it, partly because I just think it serves to reinforce the idea. The poppies, for example, I didn't go and see. I thought they just reinforced the idea that everybody was killed. I think some of the remembrance promotes really bad history. I really worry about some of the things that go on when people go off to the Western Front, and homages and pilgrimage. Hugely troubling. But, and I say this as someone on the left of politics, involved in the Lib Dems for a long time when they were left of Labour, now in the Labour Party, stood twice in Parliament. The left has a problem with patriotism. So, thinking, Rihanna, about some of the things you said, you talked about conservative values, loyalty, duty, and patriotism. They needn't be conservative values,
yeah.
Okay? Another word for those is solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
We have forgotten, people on the left have forgotten George Orwell, The Lion and the Unicorn, the English genius and socialism. And the end result of that, I'm afraid, well, why can Nigel Farage, I haven't seen Dunkirk yet, so I don't know what it's like, I'm going to see it tomorrow, it may be awful, Nigel Farage can stand up and say things about it. Why isn't Jeremy Corbyn saying, this is a triumph for the little people, the little ships? You know, there's a different patriotic narrative there, and I really worry,
I'm just aware of time.
Oh, okay. I really worry that if you're doing your good work, are always knocking patriotism, loyalty and duty. That just means that the people who put England flags up outside their houses end up voting Conservative all the time. They end up voting to leave the European Union because they think that people of progressive views have no respect for our national story that can be told in a progressive way. And I use our there as well, and I know that that's problematic for some people. But we've made a rod for our own backs in going around and doing this. Brexit was the result of it, because people thought that all those in favour of Europe hated Britain somehow.
I think I'd agree there are different patriotisms. So that there's an unthinking patriotism and a thinking patriotism, a sort of critical thinking patriotism, and you can build that. So if the proposition is, I am proud of my country, what are the things that you're proud of? And that doesn't mean starting with a menu of values that you are inculcating, that you want people just to observe that from what their lived experience of being part of that culture, part of that community, part of that history is. And I think that would be the job of any kind of educator in that scenario. So yeah, I agree.
Can I just offer to you, firstly, thank you. That was really useful feedback, and I'll definitely, that it was really, really interesting to hear that. A couple of things. Sometimes the stuff that the military does in schools is great, really, really good, and they can work really well with the schools, and that's fantastic. There is a plurality of experiences, absolutely. I would say that talking specifically about the military, they are going to choose who they send into schools, and there is not a plurality of views there. I really can't say that. But, for example, I mean, one of the things that we try and promote is alternative views from within the veterans community. So, for example, there are a lot of veterans who came out of Afghanistan and Iraq feeling very disenfranchised from the country, from why they were there, from various different things, and being very, very, you know, sort of damaged by that. And those voices aren't often heard, and they are often within veterans who served in those wars. We do a lot of work with Veterans of Peace, for example. And the other thing is, the other interesting thing is to talk to some veterans who are never going to be put forward by the military about recruiting children to the armed forces, because a lot of people were recruited at the age of 16, went in, were kind of taken out of education as a result, and are now suffering kind of long-term unemployment or, you know, whatever. So there's kind of different views, and I think it's useful to also promote those views when they come from military personnel and recognise that not all of them have the same experiences. And when you have, if the only people, sort of veterans that are being invited into schools are the ones that the military is putting forward, rather than ones that are coming from kind of other places, then I think it's not giving a you know, different views. Not to say that you should only have one of those views, but you should definitely have, you know, different ones.
And Richard, you've seen that with the Battlefield Tours programme, you know, the point raised about military figures accompanying the children on the tours.
not being those with injuries, not being those from the German army. They're ones that are carefully selected. There is a narrative that's being controlled by the MOD.
Which is understandable because they have it. They have an agenda to promote. They're not an educational institution.
Thanks. Just briefly, responding to the first point, that kind of more, you know, we should be encouraged by young people, and I think the previous question mentioned the same thing. I would concur with that, definitely. Prior to this, I actually worked at Course of Watch and delivered some sessions, as Rhiannon does, in schools, along the same lines, facilitating critical thinking. And I've always been struck by how critically young people are able to think, regardless of what we're saying to them, regardless of the set of the lesson. And sometimes, of course, they're very set in their views. But I'm just very impressed, essentially. And I think the onus is on us to encourage that and continue doing what we're doing as educationalists in whatever form that may be. But young people have a lot going on. They're doing a good job in many ways. So, yeah, I think that's a good point.
It's just what was coming out of our data from some of the schools that with proximity to military bases who invited current serving personnel into their remembrance services and or celebrations, sorry. And what we'd and what they were coming out with was the current people actually saying, "War's terrible, you want to avoid it," and actually kind of standing there in their khakis and saying this. And these are schools where usually typically the serving military person would be related to a member of staff or the pupil because of their proximity to the bases. So it's not a simple message that's being given out by that link to the military. So can raise questions.
I'd just like to thank everybody. It's been such an interesting discussion. I know that we could go on, but I was told to finish at half past, and it's after half past now. So firstly, could thank the panellists one more time for a great roundtable.